Welcome to Community Conversations, a KUND program dedicated to issues of diversity and social justice. I'm your host, Chris Harwood. Our conversation tonight is about poverty, the lack of money, the lack of resources, and in many cases, the lack of hope. Our guests for our show this evening are David Benson, the executive director of the Damiano Center, Veronica Gadelis-Langer, a homeless family advocate for the Central Hillside United Ministry here in Duluth, and Angie Miller, the executive director of Community Action Duluth. Thank you all so much for being here today. Poverty, is it indicated by a couple of factors? Is it entirely based on income? When the government tries to identify the poverty level, they're always talking about an income level. Is that the correct starting point for talking about it?
The official starting point.
Yeah.
But it's more complicated than that.
Well, there are, you know, sometimes funds or things like that that require you to track based on income. And so just in anyone working with the poverty, that tends to be the marker that's used. But it's really not very accurate, and it's just such a broad measure of something that's so disparate. I mean, every person that you meet has a different reason why they're in difficulty. I usually just think of it as people being in hard times one way or another. And right. If you're facing an enormous medical bill, your income could be really high and it could not be working, you know. And on the other hand, some people have very low incomes and really I wouldn't consider them in poverty because they choose to do that or something. For some reason, it's not a problem for them.
Can it be a temporary setback, or is it really poverty has to be sort of a long-term trend for somebody to be considered to be in poverty?
There are things such as situational poverty. I am working with a client currently who I would say is in situational poverty. She went to college and became addicted to prescription meds. Mm-hmm. One thing led to another. She got into trouble. She wasn't working, and now she's in our transitional housing program at CHUM, and she has family who are not living in poverty, so they're a support financially when she needs it, but she's an adult. She wants to be doing things on her own and pick up her mess, you know.
Right.
But, you know, she's working again and moving forward. She's paying off incredible debt. She's working with Community Action and making some really great steps forward, but that is situational. I am confident she will move out of poverty. It may not be easy and it may take a while, but I think she'll get there. The other phrase we use is generational poverty. And those are families who have children who have been raised in families where their families lived in poverty too. And so it is very hard for them to move out of that. They maybe haven't had the examples of family members who've gone to college or they've worked low-wage jobs, and so that's what they know.
And most middle-income people are really a paycheck or two away from poverty, depending on their assets or lack of assets. If you don't have anything to fall back on when you have a job loss, then you could be in situational poverty pretty easily.
Yeah, and the vast majority of people who are in poverty, it is temporary. And I mean, we live in a really wealthy country, and I've met very few people who are in a tough situation who want to stay there. They want to get out. They find ways to get out. Mm-hmm. And there's some long-term research that's been done that shows that really, I mean, like over 90% of the people who are in poverty at any given time within a few years will not be in poverty. Other people have taken their places. So it's really important to keep sight of the fact that it's not all the same people, that there's not a kind of different class of people from all of the rest of us who are also vulnerable to that possibility from time to time. It's just a condition kind of or a situation that they're in.
It's not necessarily chronic poverty.
No, that's right. I mean, now there is a group of people who are kind of stuck in poverty for a long time, and there are sometimes specific reasons for that. And we all put a lot of attention toward that group of necessity, and they're often discussed. I think that's what people are thinking of sometimes when they think of poverty. But it's really a pretty large group.
That and a lot of poverty is hidden. So you might see people who are in long-term chronic poverty or homelessness. But when you think of families struggling to get by, many of them are employed. They're the people who take care of our grandmas in the nursing home. They're the people who take care of our kids in childcare. You know, lots work full time and don't make very much money. And they are still in poverty.
Yeah.
Depending on what definition you use.
I've heard the term working poor.
And
somebody else gave an example of a woman earning minimum wage, but with two kids, that would put them officially in the poverty level, even though she's working full time.
Actually, if you have one child and you work full time at minimum wage, you're right at the poverty line. Wow. So for a family of two, the federal definition is $15,130 a year. If someone works full time at minimum wage, they make a little bit less than that.
And one thing that I always try to remember is that $15,130, if you're making $15,132, you know, you're not in a different class. It's like this very
arbitrary.
Yes, yeah. Very arbitrary number.
And that's 22% of all Duluth is at or below that poverty line.
Really?
Yes, I think it's shocking. And it's double the poverty level for the state of Minnesota, which is usually hovers around 11%.
What is the condition in the Duluth area that makes it different?
I think the wages are low. And so in the last census, one thing we found was there are 5,000 people in Duluth working in the group home industry. Now, the group home industry is a great economic engine for our region, but it doesn't pay very much. Mm. I mean, those are $9 an hour jobs. Lots of people who work in group homes have degrees. They work there full time. And so I think part of it is the wages are low.
That's it. And just that is linked, of course, just to the general economic picture here. And really, until recent decades, Duluth had some really boom and bust things going on. We still have some of the legacy of that. And some of what's replaced that is, as Angie was pointing out, you know, lower wage jobs. And so I think that is higher. Just coming back to a comment earlier about hidden poverty, over time, a third of households nationally will spend some time in poverty over a 10-15 year period. So if that's the case, that means that everyone knows someone who's been in poverty, even if they're not aware of it. Extended family, or certainly people in their circle of friends, they're just not aware of it, because people don't talk about it generally, you know, unless they have a specific reason they have to.
Another phrase I heard, and it's a cliche, is, you know, when I grew up, we didn't even know we were poor because we didn't have much, but we got by. And so somehow that's some sort of Horatio Alger-like myth. And I feel like today, I don't feel like that holds up quite the same way. Just this immediate comparison that you can get so quickly in the media with how other people in the country live, that the conditions of poverty seem so much more obvious to a person who might be in poverty now, I feel.
Well, to some extent, it is a media issue that may not have some substance. But on the other hand, there are some huge societal changes that have taken place in the last, say, 100 years. About 100 years ago, over 95% of Americans lived in rural areas, especially on farms. And so even in really tough years, they had food and housing, even if it was just survival food and housing. Now it's quite the reverse, and I don't know, I think it's maybe 2% that live on farms, and so the rest of us don't have that as a kind of safety net. So that's not there. And then along with that, urbanization and many other changes that have gone along with that, we don't have the same kind of societal supports or family supports that people did then. I mean, a lot of the things that our agencies help with, or some of the things they help with, might have been taken care of more easily by extended family in the past. Just as one example, people didn't spread out all over the country the way they do now. So you might be getting help from someone next door rather than calling your brother who lives in Seattle or something. And it's quite a different prospect.
Well, I think kids growing up in poverty definitely know they're in poverty. They can't be in sports teams or after school activities because there's fees attached to all those things. Oftentimes, maybe they're parents are getting them places on the bus. They don't have a car. I think poverty is painfully obvious to children living in poverty.
And I realize for some it's more of a long-term thing. But a person who is descending into poverty, any of the many reasons, what happens first? Does a person start to cut out some of the basic needs in their life? What goes first? Housing or clothing or food? What do they start to sacrifice first in order to just get by?
Well, it's a really tough question. It's obviously going to be very different for each situation. Part of my job at CHUM is working with a discretionary fund. And so I get folks who call who are looking help with a little bit of gas to get to their next paycheck or help paying for a medication copay. So I think sometimes it's chatting with your friend or your neighbor to find out what resources are available and see where we might be able to cut some corners. You know, the soup kitchen's open at Damiano Center today. I'll get lunch there so that I don't have to worry about food today. And so kind of piecing it together, I think it's a lot of work to figure out how to keep moving forward because it is all of these resources and it's taking the bus to get to CHUM to fill out the application to get help with the funds or it's getting up to Damiano Center for lunch or getting out to Salvation Army to get help maybe with a deposit or help with rent if you fall behind. So it is a lot of work. I don't think anybody wants to be in poverty. It is a headache and it's just tons of paperwork. So part of it might just be brainstorming with friends and family and borrowing money and trying to piece it together that way. So it's hard to say if there's one thing that maybe falls first.
So some people get into credit card debt this way because they can't meet their basic needs with their paycheck or lack of paycheck. Some people rely on payday loans, you know, a real problem later on. And I think every family is different what they cut out first. I mean, there's been a whole study in Minnesota about missing meals. So the large number of people in Minnesota who regularly miss meals, not they're too busy, but there is no food. Again, that's very individualized, I think, where people decide to cut.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. But one thing that does seem to be common is just being in shock, you know, especially if it's something that happens quickly, like losing a job or a medical situation or something like that. For people who've never experienced it before, it's very scary and you just don't know what to do. And it takes people a while usually to figure out, well, I can get a meal here or there, or get those other kinds of assistance. After the recession hit a few years ago, like about 6 months later, I started seeing people in the soup kitchen who I used to see in suits downtown or, you know, somewhere else who had pretty good jobs, and they lost their jobs and they ran out of their savings, you know, and it was about 6 months or something like that. And then they ended up coming there and they were, without exception, in shock. You know, I mean, they just didn't ever see themselves that way. And they have quite a different view, I think, now of what the Damiana Center is or any of our agencies and, and what kind of places they are. You know, yeah, they realize they're part of normal life, you know.
Yeah.
Is there shame involved, too? Is that a factor that makes it difficult for them to seek help?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, in our programs, we really try to minimize that as much as we can. That's one of the reasons we have a Kids Cafe program, is that there's just kind of a down and out feel to waiting in line for food at the soup kitchen. There's no reason why people have to have that feeling, but they do. And you just would really rather kids don't have that. So in a Kids Cafe program, there are activities and things that kind of change the focus from being just on getting food in their stomachs, which is essential, to also having some community and things going. And so then it doesn't feel quite so desperate.
I, for a while, was receiving WIC benefits because I had small kids and I was low income. And there was a little feeling of embarrassment, I would say. And I don't know that anybody made me feel embarrassed, but I felt a little embarrassed by it.
There is, I think, in the American myth, this pioneer spirit of we're supposed to make it on our own. We shouldn't have to depend on anybody else, that I have to be able to figure this out by myself. I shouldn't have to go to anybody. It's a sign of failure.
So at Community Action, we do a lot of work with groups of people, you know, and breaking isolation and forming connections between low-income people and middle-income people. And that's a way to kind of remove, I think, some of that stigma, where when middle-income people get to know low-income people personally and in a relationship, they see how hard they work and how many barriers they face. And it changes that dynamic, I think.
Absolutely. When you can put a face and a story to the statistic, I think that just changes everything.
You were just talking a minute ago, Veronica, about homelessness, and CHUM, of course, does provide temporary housing to help them have a place. Their challenge is when you are actually homeless, you don't have a mailing address. You are really kind of off the grid to try to ascend without having a place of residence or a place of contact can be an enormous hurdle right there. What CHUM does, of course, is you have some temporary housing that you provide.
Yes. We actually have quite a few different programs. We have the congregate shelter for, well, typically single adults. And then we also have shelter for families. Our family shelter is off-site, but we only have 4 units. And unfortunately, we've seen a rise in the number of families we've served. So those families are ending up at our congregate shelter. And we do the best we can to give them private space, but the numbers at CHUM have just been increasing. And it's been really a challenge for us to make sure that everybody has a comfortable place to sleep at night. In 2012, we served 75 families. The year before that, it was about 70. So we have seen an increase in the number of families. And if you were to look at our numbers from a few years ago, even, we were serving more like 40 families. So it's been a huge jump. Along that same line, as far as housing goes, we have transitional housing where families can stay temporarily. And it's a step up from shelter because they actually are paying 30% of their income for rent. They get supportive services to go along with that. Because a lot of the folks, you know, when they leave shelter, they might have found housing, but the issues that they were dealing with are still there. You know, maneuvering the system or trying to piece together the childcare or brainstorming, how am I going to get to work after dropping off my kid at childcare by the bus? All of these things to maneuver. And so just to have somebody to help assist with that brainstorming is helpful. We also have permanent supportive housing, which is an apartment like you or I would rent, but there are supportive services that go with it. And so a case manager comes into the home and meets with the family and helps maneuver through the system or give support as needed, help connect with a mental health provider if they're struggling with mental illness or things like that.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD, Duluth Public Radio. Our topic tonight is that of poverty, and my guests tonight are David Benson, the Executive Director of the Damiano Center, Veronica Gadelis-Langer, a homeless family advocate for the Central Hillside United Ministry here in Duluth, and Angie Miller, the Executive Director of Community Action Duluth.
We talked already a bit about sacrifices that one makes, and then there's also, as you said, mental health. Mm-hmm. And even if you're not a person who's suffering from mental illness, the depression that might be involved, the stress of being in poverty, all of these things impact health in general, and that really can weigh on a person. And does it create kind of a spiral? Does it become a self-fulfilling prophecy of being in a really difficult spot? Just the weight of that makes it worse and worse and worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's evidence that stress and chronic stress even creates worse health. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So there's those cortisol hormones that are created during stress have other damaging effects on the cells in your body and lead to chronic illnesses. And so it is a cycle, I think. Mm. It can be.
Well, you know, that situational depression that some people may face when they end up in a period of poverty is really challenging if you are working or if you're just trying to take care of your children. I look at some of the families that I work with, and they have appointments with mental health workers. They have therapy appointments. They have med appointments. They have all of these appointments for their health. If they were working, I don't know how they'd get there. People are trying to fix themselves. But in the meantime, if they're receiving assistance, the clock is ticking. They only get 60 months. And if they're applying for Social Security disability for more of a long-term mental illness, that's stressful too. They're still on assistance and trying to apply for a disability check that is a long process. And so I guess I'm just trying to explain that if you're working, that's fantastic. But if you have mental health needs that need to be addressed, it can make it very challenging to get to all those appointments.
Does this depression really start to metastasize? Does it create this loss of hope, this loss of belief that it's going to get better? What's the first step? What do you do with a person who's at that breaking point where they just say, I just don't know. I don't know. What's next?
Well, I think, you know, that's why Andrew's mentioning some of their efforts to connect people in groups. That's really important. And we try to befriend the people who come to us as much as they're willing and interested in doing that, so that helps break that isolation. It's going to be different for a lot of different people. For some people, it is kind of a spiral and things get worse and worse, you know, and especially if they make the wrong choices about how they deal with their situation, you know, it can really take them to a lower level in their lives. But, you know, we talked earlier, there's a small group of people who are always long-term in poverty. And one of the big factors for that is serious mental illness. And a lot of these folks, the rest of their health is really suffering because they're very vulnerable and they're living maybe on the street and they're not getting anywhere near good nutrition. And, you know, there's just a lot of factors then that start building up, and it's very hard for them to move out of that.
But I'm always amazed and awed by how many people are motivated and positive and very goal-oriented and do everything under the sun to make their situation better for themselves and their kids. Mm-hmm. And I think we see some overlapping demographics, but also some different demographics at Community Action. The way that we kind of deal with that overwhelmed and hopelessness feeling is we do long-term financial and employment coaching with people, and it's very goal-oriented and break down your plan into very small steps. And for some people, it's literally bringing in a brown paper bag full of unopened mail. And the coach will go through and open mail with the person because they stopped opening their mail because of debt and all the terrible things that came in their mail and were immobilized. And so it's just a matter of really breaking it down and setting real small reachable goals. And if the goal for today is open your mail and let's look at it, then that's an accomplishment. And so I think you can really work with people and get those small accomplishments. And before you know it, they're enrolling in Lake Superior College and really moving ahead. And
so
that's
it builds
a lot of the
it builds momentum.
Right. Completely.
We find similar things at CHUM. Our advocate who works with families living in the shelter, she meets with them daily. There's a lot of steps forward during those meetings. It might be a phone call. These aren't gigantic steps, but they're steps. It might be a phone call, but just that reminder to the family that everything we've done is a step forward and you just got to keep moving. And I think too, for folks to have somebody to listen to them, their aunt or their cousin might be there to listen to them, but they might be in a similar situation. But to come to talk to an advocate or someone who's just going to be able to listen and maybe give some suggestions or just encouraging words, I think is helpful for some folks too.
David, tell us a little bit more about Damiano, because some people just think of it as the soup kitchen, and it's really a lot more than that.
We have five programs, including the soup kitchen, and Kids Cafe is the other meal program that we have that I mentioned earlier. And then we have two clothing programs. Many, many households around Duluth donate clothing to us, and then we redistribute it, and all of our programs are free of charge to the people who use them. We have the clothing exchange, which is just simply clothing going out on racks, and then Clothes That Work, which is for people who are looking for work or have a job and need clothing for employment. All of what we do at Damiano is pretty simple and pretty direct, but really essential. And a lot of times it's removing an obstacle that might seem simple if it's not an obstacle for you, but for somebody in that situation, it can be really difficult, like clothing. I mean, if you've been homeless for a while, you probably don't have interview clothing in your backpack, you know, or you might not have the specialized clothing you need or the bus token you need to get to your job for a while or something like that, you know. And these are small things, but they're really huge obstacles if you don't have them, you know. So people often ask me, well, what could I do if I knew that a friend or family was in poverty other than just giving them money? What could I do? And this is the kind of thing you could do, is help with really practical things and just be friendly and offer your assistance in certain ways. And that in itself removes a huge obstacle, because that alone feeling is not there.
Mm-hmm. With Community Action Duluth, Angie, it's a very motivated mission. And one of the things that I like about that mission statement is that it's not just working with the people who are in need, but it's about building the stronger community from all parts of the community to work together to develop ideas and programs and different initiatives.
Exactly. Like, for example, on Monday, our tax site opens, and we're open five times a week, and it's almost completely volunteer-driven. And so we have 90-plus volunteers who will be actually preparing taxes for 1,500 low-income people between now and April. And I know Chum runs a tax site too, and it's a real immediate way for people not in poverty to interact with people in poverty and really see the reality of their situation. So people come and they bring all their W-2s for the year, and there's often many W-2 forms, how much you made and where you worked, and there's stories told between people. And so that's all part of the community engagement, of really tangibly getting people not just to provide a service, but to get to know somebody and really see what their situation is and how it impacts their families. And you can learn a lot about people in poverty that way. And it's not just crossing that class line, but we work very intentionally with people to cross racial barriers. And so for people of different races to get to know each other and learn from each other. And so we have different programs that focus on that as well. And one thing to mention along those lines are, when you look at who's in poverty in Duluth, in the last census, it was over 60% of all the African-American people living in Duluth were in poverty, and 48% of Native Americans were in poverty. Now, still the largest number of people in poverty are white, but when you look at the proportionality, it's quite high for people of color in Duluth.
That's a staggering number.
That's very staggering.
Staggering.
Yep.
Huh. As far as solutions go, education, either connecting them to getting more education and or providing them with some education through your programs. Like you were saying earlier, that for people who didn't have an example in their family of somebody who thought college was either affordable, obtainable, necessary, maybe. Is that really a useful tool? I guess is the first question.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have the stats on that. I mean, the census found that, first of all, if you don't have a GED or a high school diploma, your average wage in Duluth was $12,500. Mm. And then if you had a high school diploma, it about doubled.
Doubled.
Yes, it's very interesting. And then for bachelor's degree, the average in Duluth in the last census was $39,000, which is surprisingly high to me. But
yes.
So education, I think, for a lot of people is a key to getting out of poverty. We have a partnership with Lake Superior College, because it can be kind of overwhelming and intimidating to even get there and enroll. And so we bring people from Lake Superior College to our office, and we have workshops and connections so people can meet people at the college and feel comfortable, and we help them apply. And so I think that is one strategy to getting a better job or starting a career, is education.
It's a lot easier, it seems, in a larger urban area like New York City. Public transportation gets you anywhere and everywhere in that city within a few blocks. It's not so in Duluth. Duluth is a lot harder to get around. Mm-hmm. Twin Cities as well. It's tough. Your businesses are all located in places that are pretty close to major transportation lines, which it makes perfect sense. But for people that you help, transportation to other places to get the other services they need.
Yeah, that's a huge issue for people in a lot of ways. And we have a great bus system for a city our size, but it's because we're as small as we are, it's not, as you point out, adequate for everything that people might need to do, or convenient at least. And there's an effort in Duluth right now to move kind of homeless intake services to maybe one location, because now people can have kind of a runaround if they're trying to seek services, and it's a long ways from being set. But it would be a good thing, because people who really need a lot of help, they're going to spend a lot of their time traveling. Over 80% of the people who come to us walk to get to us. Mm-hmm. You know, if you live in Lincoln Park, where there's a lot of poverty, or farther west, or even much farther east, that'd be very difficult to do, you know. Mm-hmm. We're part of the Duluth Hunger Coalition, CHUM is too, and several other organizations, and we have scheduled our serving time, so you can get a meal in Duluth 3 times a day, 7 days a week. But you'd have to be able to get to all those places. So Salvation Army is in West Duluth. People in the Central Hillside, that's a little too far, really, unless they can get a ride somehow. Or we're working on some efforts to try to figure out who can't get to what they need and maybe have some different services to help that. But we're definitely not there yet.
Mm. I suppose, of course, the time it takes to get to these places to get the meal takes away from the time that you need to spend getting other needs met as well, looking for
sure.
work.
Yeah, your work day really gets extended when you have a child, a family that I'm working with. She works at 8, but she has to catch the bus downtown and then up the hill. She has 3 buses before she even gets to work. Mm. And then she has to be spot on for her job. I'm not saying that that's anything to do with our transportation system, but just needing to rely on public transportation. How easy it is to just jump in your car. It takes me 5 minutes to do all of that. You know,
yep.
A car definitely simplifies things.
Mm-hmm. We have a car loan program called Jumpstart, and it's got a lot of great things about it. And one thing is, I like to say it's like the only program I can think of that changes your life in an afternoon, because the day that your car is delivered to you, a nice car, and it's a very affordable interest rate, even if your credit is not great. We have a partnership with Northern Communities Credit Union, and it's just this great program. But because a lot of people are in that situation that Veronica described of these hour-long commutes on both sides of their workday to get their kids to childcare and back, and work and back. And it really can take a long time on the bus, especially if you have to transfer. So in a day, you can get rid of your car drama and have so much more time and ways to bring your kids to events. And it can really change your life if you haven't had transportation to have transportation.
I was trying to think of policy changes we can make in this state or in this city to really affect the trend. But there's so many major factors
involved.
There's
a bill to raise the minimum wage in Minnesota by a small amount. I mean, but every little thing, I think, would help.
Yeah.
From $7.25 to maybe a quarter more an hour. And I don't know if the bill's going to go anywhere, but raising wages, I think, is part of it.
I imagine the backlash to that are the small businesses who say, we can't afford it. You know, that'll put us out of business. We wouldn't be able to employ them at all. That's always the argument I've heard.
But poverty is expensive on all of us. Do you know what I mean? We're
sure.
All not as well off in many ways when we have so many people in poverty. It affects all of us.
You know, I think policy issues are really important, and changes in that realm can have huge impact. But I also feel like if we're going to make real progress, there are a lot of kind of cultural changes that have to happen that you can't really make people do. You know, every week I talk to people and I think, boy, you know, if you had just done that a little differently, you know, you wouldn't be in this tough situation. And often they're well aware of that. It's not a matter of them so much acting differently from people who aren't in poverty. It's just that in many ways, our whole culture has done things that makes us all a little more vulnerable, all with a little less margin, and some of us get caught in that. So how do you address that? I don't know. It's probably long, slow work, but it's more about how we interact with each other and how we conduct our lives, you know, and those are huge issues.
Yeah, and I think that community understanding, you know, as I talked about earlier, breaking down those stereotypes of who is homeless or who is living in poverty in our community. For me, it was a huge eye-opener when you hear that the person taking care of my child is not making a lot of money, or the person who's serving me my dinner when I go out to eat. You know, all of those things. I mean, yes, there are folks, obviously, who are on assistance who are also in poverty, but there are also people who are working and trying hard. And I just think community awareness and just taking a step back and listening to stories is really helpful.
Well, thank you very much, everybody. I wish we could talk more. It's a huge, huge topic, but I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That's all the time we have today. I want to thank our guests, David Benson, the executive director of the Damiano Center, Veronica Gadelis-Langer, a homeless family advocate for CHUM, the Central Hillside United Ministry, and Angie Miller, the executive director of Community Action Duluth. We hope you found this conversation enlightening, and we thank you for listening to Community Conversations, a KMD program dedicated to issues of diversity and social justice. Community Conversations is a KMD production with support provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. I'm your host and producer, Chris Harwood. Our topic of conversation on the next program on March 1st will be that of the infrastructure of the city of Duluth. When things were built, how they're doing, and what we're looking for in the future. That's coming up next month on Community Conversations here on 103.3 KUMD.